Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer, with co-host Dr. Carl Nadolski, again, the second greatest endocrinologist, because we have back on the podcast, hey, Dr. Susan Bryan, our esteemed Instagram colleague.
Hello.
I remain so jealous of her jam. You do the best videos.
She's got great videos. She'll surpass us all in terms of likes and follows, and she deserves it.
Yeah, what Spencer today? Well, Spencer calls my stuff play. What do you call my devices that I try to use?
Oh, it's like he's using a Fisher Price phone all the time. It doesn't work. It's not what he's doing. But, all right.
That's harsh.
Today we're going to be talking about the new switch from the term PCOS, or the acronym PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, to PMOS, just a recent shift, polyendocrine metabolic ovarian syndrome. There were brand new, not guidelines, a whole consensus paper about the shift, and it was a really big deal. Lots of people talking about it, a lot of people advocating for those with PCOS in the past. So it was kind of an interesting shift. So we wanted to bring in Dr. Susan because she had looked through the literature a little bit, this new paper, and we have as well, but we wanted to get another expert on to talk about it. So welcome back already.
Yeah, thanks. I was just talking with a patient about it just this morning in the clinic, and I kept switching between PCOS and PMOS. And every time I'd say PCOS, I kept thinking, now say PMOS.
Yeah.
It's hard to make the switch when you're talking about it.
You're right.
Yeah.
I was going to say that the patients the media must have done a pretty good job of discussing this, because a lot of patients know about this, and I was a little surprised by that. So, so it's good. It's helping, with awareness, and I think it was a good change. I don't know. I know you did fellowship a little bit before I did, but I remember back in fellowship, this was sort of an ongoing international effort. Do you remember this going on for a long time?
Yes. Yes, even in fellowship, I remember learning, like, you may not see the polycystic ovaries, and you don't have to see that, in the U.S. for the diagnosis. So, yeah, from the very beginning, learning, like, okay, it's different than maybe what the name implies.
So why don't we just go over originally the PCOS, how it came to be, and anything you can say, just the basics around it.
Yeah, polycystic ovarian syndrome was what it used to be called. Now it's PMOS, as you said. And so in the United States, the way that you diagnose it differs kind of depending on the country and what you follow. But in the United States, we typically follow you need two out of three things, because it's a syndrome. You need two out of three things to be present. One is polycystic ovaries on imaging, but that's optional. Other guidelines, you have to have that. And then the other, irregular periods. And the third is hyperandrogenism, so elevated testosterone or DHEAS, or signs of acne or hirsutism, which is the dark hair that you pluck or shave. But also, because there's no test to do to show, yes, you have PMOS, you also need to rule out appropriately other things that could look like PMOS. And so part of that, because it's a syndrome, it's not like you don't check a blood test. In the past, they would say, well, look at LH to FSH ratio, but that's not part of the diagnosis. So you want to look on exam, could this be Cushing's syndrome or disease that we're missing, or non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia? So there is a workup to do depending on, family history and exam and that sort of thing, to rule out other things. But then if you've ruled out other things and you have two of those three things, then you have the diagnosis of, used to be called PCOS, now called PMOS.
Well, what the heck causes this, though? That's what everybody always like, what's the root cause? I know there's not a root cause, because we understand. So forget root causes, but that's what people want to know. Like, what's the underlying etiology?
A million different root causes.
Right. I mean, people think of one cause when they think of root cause, but this is multifaceted. But you know, what's...
Well, there's also different subcategories, mm-hmm. you know, and so in there's, you know, phenotype A, B, C, and D. So even within that, there is different underlying things that drive it. The more classic ones are the ones that we think of, which are like the phenotype A is the classic PMOS appearance. But a lot of the things that drive type 2 diabetes, metabolic disease, also drive PMOS. And so that's how, you know, all the complicated issues of the what's really going on in type 2 diabetes, a lot of that is driving PMOS. And of course, a lot of the same risk factors exist for what you can develop with PMOS as type 2 diabetes. So insulin resistance, metabolic disease, a lot polygenetic environment influence, you know, there's a lot of those, all of those are tied up in the underlying causes of PMOS.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned, you know, polygenic, and we talk about how, say, obesity itself and obesity related diseases, which we can talk about how this fits into that. There have been a lot of genomic analyses on PMOS, and, you know, it's they use the term polygenic origins. You know, that means there's all sorts of genetic contributors across neuroendocrine, metabolic, reproductive pathways that kind of interact to all play some sort of role in this, and everyone's a little bit different, huh?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's, you see that in the subtypes of, you know, and you've had patients just like me, who the thin patients with PMOS. And that's part of that, the subtypes too, what they're trying to represent in that. And I do think a lot of that is that underlying polygenetics of that.
Yeah. What is and even in the thinner people with a lower body mass index, now we could sit and debate all day about, you know, the abdominal obesity, the, you know, the adiposity based contributor to that, because it certainly is an obesity exacerbated disease at least. But the insulin resistance, and then with that comes hyperinsulinemia, is even in 75% of the people who have a body mass index under 25 or something, like that's the statistic off the top of my head. That sounds right. So even when you have a lower BMI, it doesn't mean there's not an adiposity component to it, which is why weight loss, you know, is so important for people with PMOS. You know, easier said than done. That's why we have therapies to help it.
What's the pathophysiology, though? I mean, what's going on? Because people are like, I don't know, I got this PCOS. What the heck? Why are there androgens high? Why? When? What is that doing?
Well, the androgens, there's a brain effect of PMOS, which is that GnRH pulsatility issue. So you're getting these GnRH pulses, which is causing you to release more LH than FSH. So you get in the, you know, in the ovary, the development of more production of the testosterone, and then kind of the arrested follicles, which is what you can see with the string of pearls. Polycystic ovaries, where you have these follicles that are in arrested development, and then anovulation or erratic ovulation. So one of the mechanisms of the androgens, for example, is through that GnRH pulsatility LH, which is why they used to say like the LH-FSH ratio.
So like for people listening, just because there are some people that aren't doctors, GnRH, gonadotropin releasing hormone, comes from part of your brain, the hypothalamus, which then sends signals to another part of your brain called the pituitary gland, which then releases luteinizing hormone. That luteinizing hormone, this is why you hear a primary, secondary, even tertiary causes of endocrine issues. But then that luteinizing hormone sends down to your theca cells or your ovary to make androgens. And if there is a genetic component to this, obviously people are susceptible, and we'll get into this. We talked about metabolically healthy and unhealthy obesity, and how like we have patients that have a 60 BMI and they don't have even blood sugar issues, but then someone with even a 25 BMI, a little bit spilling fat into the wrong places. And that's genetically related, just like PMOS, what people formerly known as PCOS. It's just an interesting thing. So then all of a sudden you have more androgen, and then you combine that with the insulin resistance.
Yes.
Which then
exacerbates it, really.
Yeah, the insulin kind of drives it. Aggravates or accelerates or
whatever
it amplifies, amplifies the estrogen secretion. Right.
Yeah, I like to say the ovaries don't like seeing high insulin. Mm-hmm. You know, insulin drives obviously all kinds of things, but yeah, so amplified by insulin resistance.
Here's a question: people are like, okay, obesity. So PCOS is technically a comorbidity. We call it a comorbidity, but like, obviously, there are people that are without obesity that develop the same thing. So it seems to me that the genetic component combined, it's the same as anything, genetics and environment and the sequela of that amplifies the whole effect. And that's why we're seeing more of it now. Is that, would that sound about right?
Yes. I was just reading in Diabetes Care, gosh, I can't remember, but talking about environment. But it was exposure to something in the environment, you know, that you live close to something and how the effect it had on the endocrine things. Like, I'm thinking, isn't there a secondary thing? But I really, there are so many things in the environment and, you know, all of the endocrine disruptors, et cetera. So, yes, there are so many things environmentally that can affect. And you know, I often see it present in, you know, college student. They were an athlete in high school. Mm-hmm. They had their great exercise routine. They ate their mom's, you know, healthy cooking. They go off to college. So their environment changed. They go off to college. They stop being an athlete. They start eating in the cafeteria. And here comes the symptoms of they had the genetics. Yes, they have the genetics all along. And now they've got the environment shift that is bringing out now the more irregular periods, et cetera.
You know, but I think that brings up, you know, a good point talking about, so how many people have it? Because you mentioned how certainly in endocrinology, we've always been taught to make sure we rule out definitive. So in the guidelines, you have to rule out thyroid disorder, prolactin, and you mentioned the thing that called non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia. We can screen that with a test, and then of course other things like Cushing's. But I do have a feeling, just kind of based on anecdotal experience, and I don't have any data on this, that I don't think enough people get everything ruled out. And so sometimes I wonder, you know, if there are more people, let's say, you know, with especially the non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia, because it really acts very similarly and people can be pretty darn thin.
Yes.
That.
Yeah. I've made that diagnosis a lot. I mean, I've ruled it out plenty of times, but yeah, plenty of times someone comes along. I do like to say, when I'm seeing a new patient for PMOS, I do like to say, I want to just kind of start at the beginning, because if I say it's PMOS now, everybody's going to believe it, you know? So I really want to make sure that I've got the diagnosis right. And so then I'll do the testing. Yeah. I've found lots of cases of non-classic CH. Yeah.
Now, speaking of testing, I do have one more question for you, because yeah, I think the most recent international guidelines, you know, you talked about kind of country to country, but the most recent international guidelines that were like 2023, they finally started saying, hey, instead of the ultrasound for the polycystic ovarian morphology, you can use the criteria of elevated anti-Müllerian hormone.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
All before, kind of during my training and maybe back, you know, if you remember in fellowship, if they were, you know, studying it back then, but this is kind of the first time it's been said, yep, the evidence is enough for it to be a criteria. Do you check it a lot?
I have not been checking it. You know, mostly I read about it, and I did read that too, but no, I haven't started checking it, but more thinking about it in like POI or the sort of, you know, thinking about fertility and those sort of questions. But I haven't checked it in relation to this. Are you checking it?
You know, not as much as I probably could or should. I most of the time, because I rule out the things that need to be ruled out, and then they usually have criteria anyway, so it's usually not necessary, because they usually have some criteria of, you know, irregular menstrual cycles, androgen, whether it's clinical or biochemical. But I feel like I probably am just going to keep it in my like automatic screening, since I don't do ultrasounds of the ovaries, like the OBGYNs might more often.
Yeah,
I do a lot of ultrasounds, but I don't find a lot of abnormal images.
Right.
Go ahead.
All right, I tend to just, I do a lot of ruling out, because like there have been a few times where someone's having a lot of hirsutism and their provider was checking their testosterone and it was like 150 or somewhere around there. I was like, that's too high, and they're having a lot more hirsutism. And I believe they ended up having an adrenal androgen secreting tumor. It's like, yeah,
whenever it's above 100, you're definitely thinking,
yeah, I'm like, what?
I don't miss that. Yeah.
Yeah. Spencer, I thought all your patients were coming to see you with hirsutism because they went to one of these hormones aesthetic center, endocrine, and they get testosterone pellets. But
I figured you were going to say that.
I've had like maybe a dozen or so patients with that because of the pellets. It's always the pellets. Yeah.
It's always the pellets.
It's always
250, 350, 350 is the highest, I think.
Basically transgender levels.
Yeah, that's what I say. Like, yeah. That is.
Levels are higher than my brother. Jeez, those are pretty high. What? Okay, so explain the change. Why did they want to change the name from PCOS to PMOS?
Well, because of us kind of forever knowing when working with these things that the metabolic component is, the cardiometabolic component is very important, and it's not really represented in that name very well. The CDC, recent CDC results said, this surprised me. Carl, tell me if it surprised you, but that a patient with PMOS, now this is not talking about subtypes of PMOS, but a patient with PMOS has a 50% chance of developing type 2 diabetes by age 40.
The age 40, I guess, surprises me. I mean, we've always literally known forever that they have such a high increased risk of diabetes and increased cardiovascular disease and stuff. Yeah. I didn't know off the top of my head the age thing. I mean, that's young.
I thought that was younger than what I thought it would be. And 4 times risk of obstructive sleep apnea. 4 times higher. I mean, we have that fire, but not that much.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I guess what that does is it actually makes me feel better about, I'm a real, I don't know what it would be called, but in PMOS, because the dysglycemia or the pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes can be exposed earlier by a glucose tolerance test.
I love my glucose tolerance test.
Yeah, so I do a ton of those, and I know it's annoying for patients, but it's for this reason, and that actually helps makes me feel a lot better about having all my young adult females do it, because apparently if half of them are getting diabetes before age 40, then we're doing it right. So that's good to know.
Yes, I love a glucose tolerance test. It is definitely the most sensitive for finding type 2 diabetes early. Although just recently, I've had so many that are over 200. Like, well, that's the diagnosis of diabetes. And then, you know, they've already been on metformin. So I order a GLP-1 and then the insurance comes back and says, unless their A1C is above 6.
Yeah, that's classic.
Don't even get me started. I can't even handle it anymore. I'm throwing my computer through the window. Yep, all the time.
All right. Well, I guess let's get into the treatment type of stuff. What can we talk about treatment? Because then there's some myths and stuff that you see. I'll get yelled at if I even say anything, but I'm going to let you say it. Different things. So how do you treat PMOS?
Okay. So, well, classically, you know, for a long time, the normal ways that it's frequent ways it's treated is with an oral birth control. And the benefit of an oral birth control pill is that it regulates periods and it changes the free or circulating androgens, so it can help with the hirsutism or acne. To that, you can add spironolactone, which is also an androgen receptor blocker. So with those, you are helping regulate the periods, and you're helping improve the hirsutism or acne. You can also use metformin. That has been classically used for a long time. And that, of course, also helps regulate the periods. It can help with more regular ovulation in the desire to get, when you're desiring to get pregnant, which you would not use spironolactone in that case. We don't use that when someone's wanting to get pregnant. And also metformin, of course, can help bring down blood sugars. So that has been the classic treatment, along with, of course, lifestyle, diet, exercise, sleep, stress. We already talked about ruling out other things that we don't want to be missing. And then always looking at the list of things that someone with polyendocrine metabolic syndrome, now PMOS, is at risk for. And so that always like to go over with a patient. So that is important in the treatment, because there are risk of type 2 diabetes, prediabetes, like we're saying, infertility. So anovulation, infertility, cholesterol, high triglycerides, low HDL, the kind of metabolic syndrome, higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea, up to 4 times the high risk, and then earlier cardiovascular disease. Did I miss any in there? Those are...
That's a bit. I mean, there's a...
That seems
it should be considered a cardiovascular disease. There's risk factor. There's a large increase in earlier atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So
those things, the things that are the issues, like if they come in and infertility is an issue, then, you know, obviously you're thinking differently in your treatment, depending on what you have found as far as what is abnormal in their labs or what they're desiring, kind of helps determine the treatment. And now, of course, GLP-1 medications are being used and extremely effective in patients with PMOS. And there's actually two studies that I know of that are going to be GLP-1 prospective randomized placebo-controlled for PMOS patients. So my hope in that is that that means the pharmaceutical companies want to get an indication on this for treatment of PMOS. So I'm very excited about that. But, and this is probably both of your experience and my experience, so many patients with PMOS previously who were unhappy with their treatment, who on a GLP-1 medication feel like the world opened to them. They feel like, you know, quote unquote, normal or so much different than ever they felt on metformin, or have had success in so many ways that they never have had. And I just want to caveat real quick on that, because I think it's important for listeners to know that there's a lot of research that's been done about how long it takes someone with PMOS to get the diagnosis. Usually it's delayed by at least 2 years. Usually they've seen multiple providers before getting the diagnosis, and there is a more unhappiness in their diagnosis and treatment often with this diagnosis. So I think it is important, as we talk about the treatment, to understand that it's often kind of been a hard road for them to get even the diagnosis.
Yeah, there's a PCOS, PMOS, tirzepatide trial that was kind of a big deal. You may have posted about it. I posted about it. January kind of came out. Almost 200 people need to be in it. Phase 4. I hope it's Lilly, because I think there needs to be, otherwise it's never going to get paid for. That's what everybody's saying. Like, even because they don't necessarily meet the BMI criteria that is now not even on the package insert.
I was going to say, that's not on a label. But
it doesn't matter. Insurances don't care. And they won't, if you have a 25 BMI. So I see a lot of patients, 24, 25 BMI. It's like, you're having a decreased quality of life from the PCOS or PMOS. And there's a little bit of excess adiposity centrally, pretty lean everywhere else. Don't need to lose a lot of weight, but like, I don't know, 5 to 10% of their weight, even to get down in that 22 BMI range. And even just starting the medicine, they all of a sudden have ovulatory cycles all of a sudden.
And metabolically, 5% is so important.
So I'm hoping, I don't know, and I'm trying to look at the clinicaltrials.gov about this one, but my hope is that they put it on a label, but you know, they're going after sleep apnea and all these other things. But I think this is a very large, there's a lot of people have this that are suffering. So I'm hoping they get something.
And you know, the amazing thing is, I mean, I feel like ever since exenatide was approved in 2005 for type 2 diabetes, I think we've all sort of known this. And I think there've been enough, you know, even if they weren't perfect randomized controlled trials, you know, we've known enough with weight loss data plus, you know, GLP or other, you know, metabolically supportive therapies that they are, because we've been talking about this forever. It seems like ever since I was in med school, but it just hasn't been, you know, they haven't achieved an indication yet. Spencer, I was going to ask you, because we're talking about, you know, diet and stuff, what are the myths that you've seen? Because you're the social media guru.
The biggest myth is, even if you are in a calorie deficit, you can't lose weight. And it's very frustrating, because it turns into this us versus them, the gym bro saying calorie deficit, and then it's a lot of gaslighting back and forth of what people are trying to say. And so then I tried to explain it, going, no, it does. PMOS can make it more difficult to get into a calorie deficit, but it doesn't, you can't get around the fact that a calorie deficit would work. But it's in a calorie deficit, the principle of it is different from telling people just to eat less, move more, and use willpower discipline.
Right. That's the problem.
Two different things, but people lump them all together, and then they say, well, and you're telling me to calorie count. I'm like, you don't have to count calories. I'm just talking about the literal principle of energy balance. And it's not, people don't like it because people have then combined the thought of energy intake as a moral issue. So it doesn't biologically.
That's an obesity stigma issue.
It's biologically driven. Doesn't matter what it is, but it is an energy balance issue.
And the increase in like cravings and hunger, according to the evidence I'm familiar with, it's not even the pathophysiology of the PMOS per se. It's that it's the just the complex interaction
sequela
similar to obesity. That it's the same type of stuff because there's so much. It's all kind of the same. I did a podcast with a dietitian in England like yesterday, and that was one of the questions from ladies over there is, basically, is that the thing? And I was like, my impression based upon the studies is that not exactly just because of PMOS, but it's the complex interaction that it's the same stuff that causes anybody struggling with weight to have, higher levels of hunger cravings, all those hormones. But still weight loss, treating the obesity aspect of it is a mainstay for, it's in our ACE algorithm guidelines that we wrote. I mean, that's a goal, 5-10 more percent weight loss to help with and fertility and whatnot.
Right.
Yeah. Other myths, basically you have to follow either a very low carbohydrate diet or a fill in your blank, low dairy diet, gluten-free diet. There's always something that they're feeling is the root cause. We all agree that a improved dietary pattern from mostly ultra processed, highly palatable, energy dense foods.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Beyond that, I'm not aware of any, but I mean, the idea behind a ketogenic or a very low carbohydrate diet is lowering your insulin regardless of the weight, and which could then decrease the hyperinsulinemia and positive feedback of the ovary making more androgens. That's the concept, although I'd have to look more particularly at very low carb ketogenic diet versus something like a plant-based similar calorie type of diet and see if there's any differences in outcomes. But I don't believe that's been done.
I mean, I know obviously like the Mediterranean dietary pattern, I think has the most evidence for PMOS, like in observational studies, like an inverse relationship of PMOS features in the observational studies. But I don't think there are a lot of great randomized trials. I mean, I think a lot of the randomized trials of diets kind of look into this, like, DASH diet, I think has a lot just looking at insulin resistance and stuff. But again, I like to say that none of these things are mutually exclusive. Minimally processed, more whole foods, cutting carbs, cutting some fat, all the different things we can do to help people with creating an energy deficit, but in a quality way, like, more Mediterranean patterns and stuff.
Well, the truth is, too, if you're seeing these patients in clinic, they have already been on every last diet.
Yes,
and you're right. It hasn't worked for them. So,
that's what we see. Yeah. Doesn't matter if they're PMOS or not,
for sure.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. What? Any other myths that you've seen, Dr. Brian?
No. I think those are probably pretty accurate. I think a lot of times they've been kind of shamed and embarrassed, and that's part of their bad experience with the healthcare system. And because there really isn't a test to do to say that they have this, I think it sometimes ends up, like I've heard a lot of women say, well, people thought maybe that's what I had, but I was never actually given a diagnosis, or so they didn't ever really have anything to research and something to figure out what they could do something about, so I think having a diagnosis, having something definitive, something we can check as far as your potential risk factors, and then things we can modify with medications, diet, exercise, whatever. I do think that's really helpful to have a diagnosis, to make the diagnosis, to come up with a plan. And in my world, GLP-1s had absolutely revolutionized treatment. Yes.
I mean, the women who haven't had their period in like a year, and the first week, right after they take their injection of their Mounjaro or Zepbound, boom, it's back.
Yeah.
By
the way, they haven't had their period in a year. Make sure you're doing a very more, much more thorough evaluation.
Yeah,
trust me.
Good point.
Yeah, Are you pregnant? Yeah, it's obviously not if it's been a year, but.
Well, and when you're thinking about these women in the perimenopause years too, it's important to think about like higher risk of endometrial cancer.
Yeah.
So, right. Of course, so if they're just have stopped their periods, sometimes people will think, well, they're in menopause, but actually, no, it's from PMOS, and we need to be evaluating that because the risk of endometrial cancer.
Yeah. That, you know, I think the biggest thing, so you all talked about you can't just get a test. Here's the PMOS, PCOS test. Here are some clues, but I think there are a lot of people out there that are not getting screened for the other potential issues, like an androgen tumor.
Right, agreed.
And I don't know how to change that because everybody's mostly seeing their primary care doctors, and you know, they're not trained in the endocrine stuff because you're taught that PCOS, PMOS, it's kind of common, so that must be what it is. They have a little bit
of
weight.
It's the most common endocrine disorder in young adult females.
But instead, I think it's important to rule out those other things.
It's very important. It's mandatory. I mean, it's mandatory, technically. I think that's a good point to why this name change, you know, even though people are going, oh, it doesn't change anything. But I think it does. I think creating the awareness and sort of helping people be a little bit more aware that it's really more of an endocrine, more of a complex endocrine syndrome, to help it get away from just no big deal, I just have some polycystic ovaries or whatever, and then nothing else, because it really is an endocrine disorder. And primary care can absolutely at least screen for all the things that need to be ruled out.
I had a case similar to this, to your point. This was a long time ago, and I'll try to make it non-identifiable, but it was a college student that was referred to me for PCOS, PMOS, and she had Cushing's disease. She had a pituitary tumor.
There you go. Yeah, that's a big deal, everybody.
A big deal.
That's your big boy. You know?
That's a big. Oh. All right. I didn't even say that's a big effing deal.
All right. Is there anything else we need to? I mean, because basically this is more of polyendocrine metabolic. That's why I think the name is much more appropriate. I know people are upset because they've advocated for PCOS so long and now it's changed, but. Oh, the other thing is people want to know, is this going to get the medicine GLP-1s covered? No, you need to actually show outcomes with a clinical trial.
Right.
And I'm not trying to be mean. That's how the FDA and how insurances do things. They won't do it just because the name changed.
You know, one interesting caveat real quick is just this whole thing about, as we know these medicines are more effective, the problem we're going to have in the future with getting placebo-controlled trials. Already, of course, we have the problem because everybody's already on them from the great market. And so it's hard to get the study done, but also thinking about like, this is to the cancer risk and that sort of thing. Like, how can you get one approved? As we know, they're more and more effective ethically. How long can we have these studies of placebo controlled trials? Yeah. And stuff?
Well,
that's very
interesting. That's kind of why, to your point, exactly. That's why, I mean, tirzepatide, Mounjaro, was studied versus their own dulaglutide for their cardiovascular outcome trial, because it's unethical to for those people who are at that, and that study specifically was in people with established atherosclerotic disease, so it's unethical. So they had to compare it to another medication that had already been proven beneficial, and that's probably how it's going to keep going on. Spencer, didn't you do something about the analogy to vaccines, and everyone's like, oh, they don't test vaccines to placebo, but it's because they've already done it and they can't ethically test against placebo anymore.
We talked about it. It's a pod proven last podcast. We were talking about maintenance, I think, and it was like, in the end, I think they're going to have to start testing against semaglutide or whatever, tirzepatide. They don't want their new drug to get beaten by an older one, so they're going to probably pick something like semaglutide at least, or ideally anything really, because otherwise people will know, like, I'm not losing weight. There's no way I'm on retatrutide or whatever. I haven't lost any weight, and what gives here? So,
Nebel and the placebo arms often drop out or they discontinue the treatment because it's not only it's, in the treatment arms, it might be side effects. In the placebo arms, it's often lack of benefit.
Some of the studies now are letting us, in the patients that want to drop out, realize they're to use other anti-obesity medicines, which I think is really smart, because trying to keep them in the trial.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're less effective, of course, so with KSGLT1, but use a different AOM.
Yeah. And in some of the maintenance ones, you know, we did that podcast, they were using rescue therapy.
Yeah.
So when, because it's unethical to let people regain all the weight that they lost in those maintenance trials. So they gave them a maintenance. And then it makes it the outcomes a little bit more confusing to us, but it's also a good, it's a good thing, you know? So it's.
Yeah. I think for the general public to understand some of these that are going to be coming out, that is a lot of minutiae.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, thanks as always. I don't know if we have anything else to add about it. I think we covered it pretty well. Yeah. Hopefully everybody understands why PCOS to now PMOS understands pathophysiology. It's quite common. We didn't talk about the actual epidemiology, but
17% worldwide. 17.
All right. Mr. Worldwide. Let's and then treatment options. Saying a calorie deficit works doesn't mean eat less, move more. There are biological drivers, appetite deregulation. There were some concerns about energy expenditure differences, but the further they looked at it, doesn't seem to be much of a difference. So I think it's more of the appetite dysregulation and then the medicines that can helping with ovulation. If you're trying to fix the insulin resistance and obesity and even without that, potentially the GLP-1 medicines could be beneficial there for helping with ovulation as well. We'll see with upcoming stuff. Thanks so much for coming on. Make sure you follow Dr. Brian on Instagram. We'll have the
greatest videos on Instagram.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.